You can learn a lot about a neighborhood by looking at what is opening and closing. Take a look at Cleveland Park, for example. Two prominent restaurants are closing, citing increasing rents or slowing business. On the other hand, look at Mike Isabella's upcoming 41,000 square foot establishment at Tyson's Galleria. What happens when a restaurant leaves the neighborhood, and what does it mean when big chefs set up shop in the suburbs? Joining us in studio to discuss this is Laura Hayes. She is food editor at the Washington City Paper. Laura, good to see you. Thank you for
joining
us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Eric Bergman is director of operations for the Neighborhood Restaurant Group. Eric Bergman, thank you also for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Eric, I'll start with you. What does a restaurant bring to a town or a neighborhood more than the food? What purpose do restaurants serve?
Absolutely. I think the biggest thing that we strive to achieve when we open a restaurant is to create a gathering place for residents to enjoy. Food and beverage are great medium for people to come together over. And so we always design our spaces and consider where we're going to open. That's one of the major considerations we have when we open.
How does access to dining affect where you choose to live? What happens in your community when a restaurant opens or closes? Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show or email to kojo@wamu.org. Laura, our region is changing rapidly. What role do restaurants play in how a neighborhood changes and how a neighborhood develops?
Sure. I mean, I think if you look at some of the pioneers that went into the neighborhoods that are becoming the most populated with the hottest dining establishments, they really, even one of Eric's restaurants when Birch and Barley opened on 14th Street, that really kind of creates this buzz. People want to move there. It's one of the greatest things that can happen to a neighborhood, I think, is to have a reliable anchor come in. Also, like Red Hen and Bloomingdale did something similar. And then, you know, that brings in retail, that brings in more foot traffic, and that can help a whole slew of small businesses open up.
I was going to ask you whether new restaurants can signal gentrification, but I want to go specifically to Cleveland Park for a second.
Sure.
Because that neighborhood is not being gentrified. That neighborhood is essentially not changing its character particularly. It is one of the more affluent neighborhoods in the city, but it is nevertheless losing restaurants. For a lot of people, that doesn't make sense, but please explain.
Your timing is perfect because actually yesterday I talked to Richard Nguyen, who whose family owns Nam Viet. And,
yeah, in Cleveland Park, that's closing.
Park. Yes, exactly. Closed as well as its neighbor Ripple. And he said that, you know, it actually wasn't rising rents or anything like that. He said his landlords only raised his rent by a couple hundred dollars here and there. But he just said, and I echo his theory, that it's competition. Everyone's streaming down the hill to 14th, to Shaw, to Navy Yard. The whole city is kind of shifting east, if you will, over to H Street, too. So I think when restaurants pick up and leave, it can be more than just kind of the financial factors like rent and other.
And I read where somebody from that neighborhood was saying that all of the people under 40 who have moved in there are now calling for more density, that mm-hmm. even though it's an affluent neighborhood, they don't have the kind of density that they want. And if they get that kind of density, maybe then the restaurants will stay because there'll be more foot traffic.
Exactly. Richard said yesterday that Cleveland Park's going to have to take a good long look at itself and consider whether it wants to have some of these big developments come in where you have multiple restaurants, multiple retail stores kind of on the ground level, and then you build up. That would certainly change things and make it more competitive. But it's, you know, it's up to the residents if they want to see their community change from this kind of quaint mom and pop.
Eric, the Neighborhood Restaurant Group's first concept was opened in 1997 in the Delray neighborhood of Alexandria. That was the Evening Star Cafe. That opening was one of the catalysts of the community's growth. What is it that you take into consideration when picking a location for a restaurant?
We always consider what's already there, of course, and we're not a group that likes to bring in a specific competition for a concept. We like to see what the need is in the neighborhood and fill that need. Whenever possible. I think the gathering space comment I made earlier applies directly to the Evening Star Cafe and exactly to your point. We created that institution now as a anchor for that neighborhood for people to come to for a Tuesday night or a Saturday night meal, whether a special occasion or a casual weeknight meal or a get-together with friends.
How does the desire for restaurants vary depending on where you are? How does one neighborhood's desires differ from another?
I think it, you know, obviously starts with the residents and what they're looking for. as we shift, you know, into the suburbs, the desires become different. As a suburban resident myself and a married person with children, it's difficult to get into the city many times for an occasion, both financially and logistically. So the more options that people have closer to them, I think the more they're apt to use them, especially when they're particularly compelling and well thought.
Laura, speaking of the suburbs, in a recent story in Washington City paper, you noted that chefs were more and more setting up shop in the suburbs. What reasons were you hearing for why this was happening?
Sure.
What is happening?
Sure. So, I mean, it's not a mass exodus, if you will. It's kind of as if, you know, D.C.'s kind of sprung some leaks and some chefs are going out to the land of opportunity, mostly because there's just such great demand there. Several reasons. I mean, chefs and restaurateurs, like everybody else, don't like sitting in traffic, don't like sitting on 66. So there's, you know, of course, the regular reasons. But also, just the allure of kind of having a neighborhood welcome you with such open arms. Sometimes when restaurants open in D.C. proper, they're met with immediate skepticism. But out there, the demand means they're welcomed. People are so excited they have a place to go to. And there's also the allure of the regular diner. I think in D.C. there's this checklist mentality where we're always trying to try the one restaurant we haven't tasted yet. But out there, you get the stability of having return customers, which I think Eric could speak to is very important to keeping the bottom line afloat. There are also some people I talked to. A name came up, Tom Sietsma, you know him, the
sure.
critic of the Washington Post, and they say, you know, he's not coming out here all the time. Sure, he'll go to Patamac Farm, he'll go to the Inn at Little Washington, but, you know, we actually get to cook for the customer instead of the critic, and so that pressure coming off is also helpful. And finally, I would say that chefs out in the suburbs have maybe greater work-life balance. Something here, they work, you know, 12, 13, 14 hours a week.
And spend 4 hours each day commuting.
Exactly. So even if you eliminate that, that helps them spend more time with their families like anybody else. But also restaurants in the suburbs tend to close a little earlier. So even that 1-2 hours that they get home and see their kids maybe before they go to sleep, every little bit counts.
Eric, rents are also generally cheaper outside the city or less expensive outside the city. What role does rent play in where restaurants choose to settle?
It's certainly a major factor. Anytime we're looking at the cost of the business, it's something we have to consider as we open restaurants. And I think there's a lot of opportunity as we find developing neighborhoods, which is something we've always tried to do since our first opening in Delray, but also going into Logan Circle. But also now it's shifted a little bit in different development ways with, I live by the Mosaic District, for instance, in Fairfax County.
Falls Church.
Exactly. And that's been a great place for us to go to. It's very close to our home. But the impetus or the attraction for people to come to a center like that makes it easy. And those rents aren't always as cheap as we like to think they are just because they're in the suburbs. But there's other factors coming in there, some maybe more reliable business to come in on a regular basis. But certainly rent does play a huge role in where we decide to go.
But speaking of costs, I read in the City Paper piece this morning about legislation that's being introduced into D.C. to help restaurateurs if they're having problems meeting the rent, to allow them from taxpayer dollars as much as $50,000 a year. But one of the restaurants that's moving out in Cleveland Park said it's not just simply the rent. You have to understand what costs are. We are being asked to pay $180,000 for a new refrigeration refrigeration system. So it's not just rent, Laura.
It's so many things. And staffing, too, is very much more competitive, I think, in D.C. Restaurants are constantly looking for people to come and work. And out in the suburbs, sure, maybe you're getting people that aren't career servers that are there for a summer job, but there's a different pool to pull from. So I think that could also be helpful. I mean, when you talk to chefs, that's the number one talk around the water cooler, that there's just hardly anyone left to hire.
It's true both front and back of the house. I mean, talent in the city, and just because of the market being exploding so much as it has over the past decade, The pool has shrunk. Moving here from New York, there's a constant stream of unemployed actors, for instance, that can always fill the roles. But it's true, front and back of the house, talent's huge. Management, hourly employees, and that's also a huge cost consideration, too, if we're talking about the economics of restaurants.
We mentioned, Eric, that you live in Falls Church. What are we talking about when we talk about a suburban restaurant? Is there a typical definition of what a suburban restaurant is? Or, as some people say, we're talking about suburbs that are looking for some of the same amenities that can be found in the city.
I think what's interesting about suburban restaurants, and something that we find in a lot of our in our suburban locations, is the need to cater to both an adult clientele and as well as a family-based clientele, which can be a tricky line to walk. So when you say typical, those are the factors when I think of typical, and I think you think of very American based cuisine. But I think certainly where I live and in the surrounding area, we have a ton of ethnic cuisine that we enjoy, and I think I'm excited for my kids to grow up in with those experiences, because it's certainly not something that I grew up with, because coming up in suburban Massachusetts, there wasn't a ton of ethnic options. It was a very straight down the road pub fare type of a situation. I think that's evolved too, as more people have more chefs and culinary professionals have moved out to the suburbs, has created a much more compelling restaurant option.
Yeah, it's forcing us in the city to go out to the suburbs to find some of the better ethnic cuisine these days. Laura, is this a sign of changes in the suburbs? Are the suburbs urbanizing?
I think so. Also piggybacking off a little bit of what Eric said, I talked to Jeremy Ross, who used to work for Ashok Bajaj, several of his restaurants in the city, and now leads the bar program at Sense of Thai in Loudoun County. And I think people are tired coming in D.C. for their nightlife. He said, you don't know how much suppressed partying there is until you give someone a DJ. And he said, after the kids and the families clear out, they, brush the crayons off the table, turn on the music. And he said he was pulling housewives down who were dancing on the top of the bar because they're just so starved for not only dining but nightlife. And I think that restaurants that do both well have a high potential to succeed. So, yes, I do think the suburbs are urbanizing. They want a taste of everything that we have here, and there's tremendous opportunity to go get it.
At least anecdotally, however, it seems that Prince George's County has been left out to some extent of the restaurant boom that seems to be going on outside the city. Why do you think that is?
Oh, gosh. I might defer to Eric on this one just because I'm not overly familiar. I do think it's a shame. I would like to see more people go out there. There's a tremendous underserved community who's begging for restaurants. I don't know if you've ever done any market research out there for a concept.
We have. We've investigated in Hyattsville, for instance, and there's a lot of good happening, I think, in Hyattsville, for instance, as one example. But when we were considering this before, one of the interesting things, I think, is when you think of Prince George's County right now and the development they're seeing in the culinary world, we're looking at MGM. We're looking at these massive installations as opposed to a neighborhood restaurant. Mm-hmm. And I honestly couldn't speak to why or why not they're going in, but I think there's a desire there.
There was an interesting piece last year by Dan Reed in Washingtonian Magazine, who grew up in Prince George's County and his family, and he said that a lot of it has to do with the policies in Prince George's County. They see it as the first affluent African-American-dominated African-American suburb, would like it to remain that way, and feel that by bringing too many city amenities there, they may attract too many transients and change the character of the place where they live. But he says that unless that changes, Prince George's County is likely to lose out on what is a developing trend in the Washington area.
Well, I will say that, as a company, we're kind of Virginia-based, and we opened our first Maryland location last year. But for us, there was an alcohol concern, access from a policy standpoint of being able to access some of the products that we, tend to highlight and seek out, which are some of the more harder-to-find things. But luckily, they have made many changes in the state and in the county, and in Montgomery County, for instance, especially, to ease a lot of those restrictions and access to the products that we were looking for, which made it a lot easier, and why we could actually open that restaurant.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Eric Bergman is Director of Operations for the Neighborhood Restaurant Group. Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Laura Hayes is Food Editor at the Washington City Paper. Laura, don't be a stranger. Come back, visit us again.
Thank you.
That's it for the show today, but there's always more happening here online. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kojo Show. We'd like to continue today's conversations in that digital space. So if you've got a personal story to share about the non-binary gender option for DC driver's licenses or what restaurants can mean to a local neighborhood, you can share them with us there. Don't forget to meet us back on the air tomorrow at noon. We'll explore what dental health disparities tell us about the nature of poverty in our region. We'll also check in with some young women and girls in our region who are getting a summer education by, well, rocking out. That's tomorrow at noon. Until then, thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schrobsdorf, Ruth Pam, Mark Gunnery, Avery Kleinman, and Patrick Fort. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Cliff Gallagher has been on the phones. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Nandi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.